I'd like to dedicate this year of Echanishmas of Zwick, Recha Tzadik Levrach. We went to the, some of the Falsmi Yeshiva went with me to Levi on Friday. He was a person that was a tremendous Tzadik and a Talmud Chacham, a person that lived a life of Torah. And exemplified perfection to a very, very high degree. And I think it's appropriate. I mean, Mevatlin Talmud Torah Leitzos Ameis, you know, Mevatl the Yeshiva because of the Kavod Ameis. Apparently, the Halacha sees fit that even Talmud Torah, which is the highest form of our involvement in mitzvahs. In the bottle because of the Kavod HaMeis to speak a person should recognize evaluate who a mace an individual was the time when he passes away from this world. Apparently the Torah sees fit that we should spend time contemplating such an individual understanding of life. It's for our benefit. And the reason, of course, why it's done when a person passes away is because, like the Gemara says in Brachas, the Gemara says that when the Talmidim, famous Gemara, the Rav mentioned it many times, that when the Talmidim of Rebbe, and, after they came back from Rebbe's Levaya, so the Gemara says that they were sat down to eat bread and had a shaila about the bracha. And once I said, Rebbe Meis, Anan Bechzer Mazon Le'Avina. Rebbe passed away, and we don't even know the proper way to make a bracha. So what does it mean? It means to say that during his lifetime, they didn't appreciate. They couldn't fully appreciate Rebbe. And after he passed away, that's when they fully realized what his value was. So that's a part of human nature. That the person always has ambivalence. The person always has ambivalence towards other people. Towards the Rebbe, there's a certain type of ambivalence. There's even an emotion of rebellion, and prevent the person from realizing, recognizing what his true value is. But after the person is nifta, person passes away, so then the only thing that's left is the other side of the person's emotion, which is the appreciation, the recognition of who that person was. And the same thing is true not only of a Rebbe, but the same thing is true of a person, any human being, that during the person's lifetime it's difficult for us to appreciate what he really is. Because it's almost as if our appreciation of him takes away from us. Because there's a certain envy that man has, an inherent envy in his nature, that prevents him from recognizing the good that another person has. He feels that recognition of that good is, so to speak, like in an unconscious state of competition. Recognition of the good in another human being takes away from his own self-evaluation. But after the person is nifta, there's no more identification with that person. So then a person is able to be objective about it and to recognize what this individual was and to appreciate his life and to learn from it and to gain from it. And Rav Zwick was the type of a person that was an exemplary individual. The person who lived a life of Torah and mitzvahs, very, very high degree. He was a person that was a very quiet individual, and one of those rare people that spends their lives quietly, unknown to many, many people. I mean, not a person who is after recognition. A person who lives in the world, the quiet world of reality. He spent his time, I mean, basically learning and doing chesed to a tremendous degree, and yet being a very anonymous individual. Like, very few people, I think, except the ones that are very close to him, recognized what he really was. There's a tremendous Baal Chesed in a very quiet way. And I can remember that he had, I mean, a tremendous Avas Yisrael, which was a part of his nature. I mean, like, I remember, like, he didn't know me that well, but I remember one time he was at my house, and he asked me how I'm doing. I mean, he had a concern for other people. He asked me how I'm doing. I had a shtel at that time in Avron, so he told me, he said, well, he says, how he's doing financially. So I told him that time the situation was difficult. So he said, we have to try to get the shul to take care of your mortgage. I mean, his concern with my financial situation that, I mean, he didn't have to be concerned about it. But he was such an individual that he was just naturally, he saw a person, he was naturally attuned to thinking to himself, I mean, what way could I help this person? What could I say to help him? I mean, it's an amazing phenomenon, very rare. And one time I remember there was a situation with a chaver of mine that he thought that this person may be involved in a shiloh, something that might be usher. So he told me privately, he called me on the side, told me privately, you know, maybe you should talk to this person about this. I'm sure you know he's unaware of the shiloh, of the problem. But simultaneously, he said, then after he told me this, he said, but, you know, how are you going to tell it to him? Don't make him feel bad. I'm sure he doesn't realize. And I mean, he was concerned with a hefeach hefeach, but it wasn't with a bitterness. It wasn't with the contrary, it was with chesed. I mean, he wanted to make sure the person shouldn't feel hurt, and yet, of course, prevent the person from violating the avera. I mean, this is the kind of individual he was. He was a rebbe in TI. He taught the girls division in TI. He was a rashiv in MTJ, and he was known that any girl that took his course, I mean, couldn't fail the course. It's impossible to fail. I mean, he gave out A's. I don't know, maybe he gave out a B, or I don't know if he ever gave out a C. But he used to say, look, he says, a girl comes to school, TI, after a whole day, and it's a difficult schedule. I mean, she's coming to learn Torah. Says, how could I possibly assume upon myself to fail her? I mean, who knows? Do I know the personal situation of the individual? Maybe she has a difficult time, but in different circumstances, I can't get involved in each individual girl. But if I fail her, maybe it'll be a person that it'll break her. I mean, it'll cause her to be depressed. Who knows how I can affect her life in an unfavorable manner by doing something like that. I can't assume such responsibility. It says no one can fail in my courses. And I mean, he was a person, that was his way of thinking. Was a tremendous Baal Chesed. Tremendous Baal Chesed. But of course, some people say, well, what do you mean? I mean, education, you have to, you know, there's a system. But the truth of the matter is that we Jews never really had much of a system of education. We produced the greatest thinkers in the world, but if you, in terms of a system of education techniques, that we really don't have too many techniques. I mean, our technique was essentially based upon a thorough knowledge of what the highest level of human thought is, thorough knowledge of Chochmas Hashem, and the second aspect of our educational system was the recognition that in teaching people, the important thing is to reach the underlying individual. That's the essence of education. We don't have too many tests. I don't see anywhere in the Gemara where they mention that Chazal gave tests. Because the test is an artificial type of way of getting people to cram certain facts into their mind. The main thing in education is the relationship between to reach the individual, to reach the personality, the soul of the individual. That's mainly our method. And he partook of that to a very great degree. He was a person that was all his life, I mean, a sameach b'chalko, you know, was very happy individual, extremely happy individual, very satisfied. He was person. I mean, to him, enjoyment of these come out to Rockaway. Years ago, a lot of people used to come out to Rock for the Rockaway. A lot of Rosh Hashiva used to come out. Was a place that a lot of the Yeshiva world would, many years ago, the Rockaway for the summer was the only break that they had, because it was close to the city, so they, I remember, like, his great enjoyment was, he'd take a walk on the boardwalk early in the morning, you know, enjoy the fresh air. I mean, he was a person that partook of the enjoyment of this world, but like a philosopher said, the quiet pleasures of this world. A philosopher enjoys the quiet pleasures of this world. People who aren't perfected enjoy the wild pleasures, the wild emotions. But a person who is happy, he enjoys this world, he enjoys the physical pleasures, but different types of pleasures that he enjoys. Pleasures which are in line with a state of mind that is conducive to thought, not pleasures which a person tries to lose his mind. See, and this is the type of person he was, and he enjoyed Olam Haza, I mean, but the enjoyment of Olam Haza was always based around the keeping the personality in a state which is most conducive towards learning and towards mitzvahs. That's the type of individual he was. He was also, I would say, you know, it's like my brother said, he's my brother's father-in-law. My brother said to me personally, says, like, it's like a door has passed away, a generation has passed away. And I thought about it, and the truth of the matter is that he did represent it did represent the passing of a generation, because it was a different, a lot of young fellows today, I mean, of course, didn't have the opportunity to see the former generation, but he was from the Mir Yeshiva, and he was from a group of people that their hashkafa was a lot different than people's hashkafa today. He was here before before many from people were in America, and the people in those days, I would say, not to be disparaging towards people today, but the people from that group, their philosophy, I would say, differs from today's in the sense that they place their prime emphasis was on pnimius. They didn't like chitonius. They didn't like any ostentatious type of religiosity. And they didn't wear beards. I mean, he had a little beard later, a little bit, but basically all the fellows in the Mir Yeshiva, from Mir Yeshiva, were all clean shaven, and they didn't put any emphasis upon the external appearance. As a matter of fact, it was really a shikan that in many places that the emphasis should always be on pnimius, on the internal, because if a person places emphasis on the chitzonius, on his external appearances, what happens is that a lot of energy is diverted towards that area, and it becomes something which is very superficial. But on the contrary, the emphasis was placed upon the internal perfection, and that's the kind of individual he was. And he was a deep person. And I don't, from what I know, I mean, of course, you can't figure another individual unless you're with him all the time. But I can only say this, that what I know of him, I mean, I would say that he was a person that couldn't speak Lashon Hara. I mean, Lashon Hara was like an alien thing to his nature. Because he wasn't involved in that type of a thing. I mean, he was always involved in learning, and he had a satisfaction. He lived in a certain... He was like a person that lived, from what I used to always observe in him, he was a person that lived in a... He always lived in a certain type of reality. Different type of reality than we see, than most people see. And he was very content and happy in that reality, and therefore he never would involve himself. I mean, Lashon Hara and things like that, talk about people, wasn't even enticing to him. It was in a different type of a world. He's totally satisfied being in the world of the world of perfection. The individual was a remarkable individual. I mean, a great tzaddik. And I would say that it's certainly is important for us to recognize such a lifestyle and to appreciate it. And it's difficult in today's world because today's world is exactly the opposite. Everything, I mean, as you look around the world, everything is chitzonius and success and ostentatiousness, and we can't even imagine a person being a great individual if he's unknown. I mean, to us, a person's unknown, I mean, how could he be great? Great means popular. And emotionally, it's a difficult thing for us to accept, but the truth of the matter is that that's the way it is in reality. And anyone who knows or has any idea of the knowledge of the human soul knows that it is that way. As a matter of fact, Gemara says that Olam Hafach Reisu, that the next world is completely the opposite. Al Yonu Lamata V'Tachtanu Lamala, that those who are on the forefront in this world and the other world are way back of the line. You can't see them. The ones that are in this world are unknowns, are great in the next world, which means greatness has nothing to do, very little to do with how popular a person is in this life. On the contrary, a person who is a perfected person, unless he has to, will avoid the limelight. And that's the way we have our famous individuals, famous people. I mean, Esther and Malka, Mordechai, but Esther and Mordechai, we wouldn't know about them if it wasn't for the fact that a certain event occurred and they had to act. But they weren't individuals that acted because they wanted to be famous or well-known or play an important part in history. I mean, that wasn't their motivation. That wasn't their motivation. Okay, let's... let's take a look at the Mishnah that we're doing over here in Avos. Parashlishi, we left off with the last thing we did was the Mishnah on Yedalit. Now we come across a totally new Mishnah. The Mishnah starts off like this. It's a very famous Mishnah because of what the Rambam did with it. But let's take a look. Rashi, the plain shot in Rashi, and some people, as a matter of fact, feel that the Rambam actually had no right to take this Mishnah and to use it for what he wanted to. And they feel that the Rambam just utilized the Mishnah because, I mean, a lot of people maintain that way. He utilized the Mishnah because he was a philosopher, and he wanted to take the Mishnah and to twist it to his own, satisfy his own purpose. But let's take a look at it. Mishnah says, "Hakol Tzafui." Of course, I mean, I'm not saying I endorse that position, but I'm just mentioning to you that a lot of people feel that way. "Hakol Tzafui v'Rashis Nesuna." What does it mean? "Hakol Tzafui." Everything is known, seen. Seen by who? Seen by God. That's what "Hakol Tzafui" means. "Hakol Tzafui" means everything is known by God. Okay, Rashi says, whatever a person does in his chamber of chambers, Tzafui v'golu l'fnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu, is observed and is revealed before God. Okay, that's one side of the statement. And the other side of the statement is v'rashus nesuna. V'rashus nesuna means, and permission is granted. What does it mean? Rashus nesuna biyodo shel adam lasos. The permission is granted to man. He has the ability to do. Shenema, rei nasati lefanecha ayom esachayim v'esatov v'esamoves v'esara. Behold, I have given before you today the that which is life and that which is good and that which is death and that which is evil. And it says, uvacharta b'chayim, you should choose that which is life. That which is good. So man has the ability to distinguish from any other animal. He has the ability to make a choice. Every animal is constrained. There is no choice that the animal can make, because the animal is constrained by instinct. And everything is basically predetermined in his action. But man who has a tzelem elokim, he can rise above his instinctual activities. He's not constrained by his instinct. And he's capable, because of his intellect, because of his chachma. And I unfortunately, I don't have a better word for the term intellect, but it's not an exact translation. Because when you think of intellect, the person usually thinks of the mechanical part of the brain that's capable of making calculations. Like the intellect is, or even if you think of inductive intellect. But the inductive is the part that makes constructs theories. But still, there's more to it than that, because there's a relationship between that part and the soul of man. When we say the intellect, when the Rambam talks about a person as an intellect, it doesn't mean that he has very high IQ. We think of IQ in terms of intellect. But that's not what Yad is thinking. Because a person can have very high IQ and really not be in reality. When we speak of intellect, we don't mean just a high IQ. We mean an intelligence that is geared, that perceives reality. Now, the perception of reality is not determined by a person's IQ. A person can have a very high IQ and still not see reality. Be a great mathematician, and yet what reality is philosophically, he has no part of. So intelligence in Yadis is a different meaning than what it usually does in the secular world. It's not simply just, it's more than intelligence. What it means is, it means the ability to penetrate and to perceive and to understand a reality that is beyond the senses. That's what it means. Now, since man has that ability, man has that ability to do so. So God gave man Bechira. Bechira means simply, now there's a lot of questions about free will, a lot of philosophical questions about free will. I'm not going to get involved in the discussions of the later philosophers about what exactly it is. But I'm just going to describe it as we know it from Chazal. That much we can say. But we know what Chazal mean is that There is not in man. In man, there is no control. A person cannot say, my instincts overpowered me and I'm simply unable to act rationally. That is not true. On the contrary, the rational element of man, and by rational again, I don't mean what the secular world means by rational. I mean what Yadus means by rational. Rational means the ability to perceive a reality which is beyond the senses. The rational part of man has the ability, on the contrary, to subdue the instinctual. In that respect, man differs completely from any other animal. And the rational element is so powerful that it's capable of subduing the strongest emotions and the strongest instinctual parts of a man's nature. It doesn't mean he could subdue it immediately. It doesn't mean that he could subdue it readily. But in the long run, it is the most powerful force. And if a person is a chote, that's the whole idea of tshuva. Tshuva means a person isn't always able in one moment to overcome his passions. But if he recoils and withdraws into himself and analyzes his emotions and his instincts, he's capable, through analysis and through understanding, he is capable of uprooting a very powerful emotion. He has that capacity, he has that ability. In that sense, he's unique, and that is what is meant by Bechira Chofshis. That's precisely what is meant by Bechira Chofshis. Bechira Chofshis means that man is capable of doing that. He has that ability. Okay. So, therefore, what the Mishnah is saying, in the plain pshat of the Mishnah, which is really Rashi's pshat, it means akol tzofei. It means that God knows everything that is going on with man. He's aware and he has knowledge of every confrontation that a person has, and every situation and every choice that's placed before him. God has full knowledge of this. Nevertheless, man has the ability to make this choice. So according to Rashi, all Rashi states is that that's the extent of it. A kol tzofei rishus nizuna. That God knows and yet man has the ability. According to Rashi, what we don't understand is, what is the connection? What's the relationship between these two segments? All right, what? I mean, it's two different phenomena. Yeah, God knows, that's one thing. And second thing is, man has a choice. But what is the interconnection between these two things? Obviously, the Mishnah is trying to tell us there's some relationship over here. That's where the Rambam comes in. The Rambam says that what the Mishnah is referring to is a philosophical problem. A famous philosophical problem. Which is, and the Rambam says this is, in fact, one of the greatest problems of philosophy, as Rabbeinu Yonah says, "V'hu pella." Pella means it's an astonishing reality. Astonishing. Of course, in Yadus we don't have we don't have anything in Yadus which contradicts the human mind, because we believe, as Sadja Gaon states clearly, in all the Rishonim state, and the Psukim, and everything, I mean, that we are expected to make judgments based upon our sense perception. First, we accept the reality of our sense perceptions, and secondly, we accept the reality of our ability to understand, of our knowledge, and we're guided by our knowledge, and that we consider to be real. And nowhere in Yadus do we have a situation that we deny our innate categorical structure of thought. But we accept, we say that the categorical structure of thought is given to us by God, and on the contrary, we are obligated, that's the Bechira, we're obligated to follow what our mind tells us, and to follow Chachma, live according to Chachma. But it doesn't mean we don't have any problems. It doesn't mean we don't have any questions. We have a Pella. Pella means something which is astounding. It's not a contradiction. It's not an inherent logical contradiction. But it's a difficulty. Okay? I mean to say, I'm referring, of course, to Lahavda, what the Christian concept is, that one and three, and three is one. I mean, an impossible thing for the human mind to conceive. And they maintain that, according to their belief, that that this is what God wants them to accept. We don't have such a thing. It's nonsensical. Because something which is inherently impossible cannot be anything that that we will accept by cannot be a matter of faith. That's an impossibility, because once you reject your inherent knowledge, you have nothing left. But there's such a thing as a Pella. Pella means it's not an inherent contradiction, but it's a difficulty, many difficulties. You have difficulties in physics, but you don't find contradictions that would contradict the mechanism of the human mind and would cause us to simply say we have to give up. So yeah, there's such things as Pella. This is one of the ploim, one of the astonishing points. Serious problems in philosophy. And the Rambam speaks about at greater length, I should say, in the Yad HaChazaka, and at very great length in the Mara Nevuha. The question the Rambam perceives here is as follows. Hakol Tzofli means God knows everything that will occur. And yet, Harashus Nesuna, which means that man has the ability to make a choice. So what is the problem? I mean, it doesn't seem like, I spoke about this once before on the tape. What is the problem? If God knows which choice he will make in the future. God knows which choice he will make in the future. So what's the problem? I mean, it's like, almost like the Rivet says, that it's like it's similar to a person that's gazing in a crystal ball and knows what the choice the individual is going to make. So what is a serious problem? God knows the future. No, but it is a serious problem. The serious problem is because it's based, God's knowledge, you see, is not like our knowledge. The Rambam makes a point of that in the Yad HaChazaka, that God's knowledge is not as an observer. God doesn't observe us. He is not outside of us and he observes us. Not the way it is. We may imagine that to be the case, but that's not the way it is. That would be like taking our concept of knowledge and projecting it onto God. That's not true. While the Torah does seem to describe it that way, but that's only because the Torah has to have some way, that's what Chazal say, Dibre Torah B'loshim Le'adam. The Torah speaks in human terms, like Yad Hashem, God's hand, and God's anger, but of course, those who have a deeper understanding realize that the purpose is that and anybody can read the Torah. A plain person can read the Torah and gain a certain knowledge from the Torah, even though he's not a great philosopher. Of course, the Torah is written on many, many levels. It's the ingenuity of the Torah. It's only God could write a book on that level that could be written in a way that Chacham sees the deepest ideas, and the plain person also walks away with something. So on the surface, the Torah does give such a description. But that's not. But those who understand the ideas more deeply realize that it's only a description. It's not really valid and accurate in terms of a true understanding, a deep philosophical understanding of God's knowledge. But the Rambam says in the Yad HaChazaka, Rambam says that God's knowledge is not that he looks outside of himself at us, observes us like an observer in the distance. But basically, he knows himself, and by knowing himself, he knows the world. which means to say the mashal the Rambam gives, of course, in the Mor Nevuchim, the famous mashal of the clockmaker, that the clockmaker knows what time the clock is, even though he can't observe the clock anymore. Why? Because he knows the mechanism of the clock, he understands it, and he knows what time he set the clock at, and therefore he knows 2 days later, 2 months later, 2 years later, he knows what exactly how that clock is, what that clock is, what the hands of the clock are at, because he understands the clock. You see, whereas an observer knows the clock because he observes, he sees where the hands of the clock are at. So our knowledge is knowledge, all of our knowledge, all human knowledge. That's why human knowledge and God's knowledge are two different realms, two different spheres. Because all our knowledge is really just the knowledge of an observer. We observe. Science is good at observing. I mean, that's how they base everything, is based on observation. But observation is really a weak form of knowledge, because it's like the person who knows the clock based upon the fact that he sees it. That you can't equate that to the individual who constructed the clock and knows exactly where it's ticking, what it's at now, because he understands the whole mechanism behind it. The person who is an observer only sees the hands. That's all he sees. He has no knowledge of the whole mechanism that's going on behind those hands, and what causes it, and why the clock is ticking this way, and where it's at a certain time. It's a very weak type of knowledge, superficial knowledge. He can, by deduction, he can discover that there must be a mechanism behind the clock if he makes the first deduction, because why, he knows, he has some understanding of the laws of nature, and why are the hands of the clock moving? Must be a mechanism behind there. So he could, by way of deduction, he could know there's a mechanism. He might even be able to construe in his mind the type of mechanism that would be responsible for the hands being in a certain position. And if he gets a little bit more knowledge, more observation, he can put together more what exactly is going on behind the scenes. But whatever he's doing is very limited, because it's, first of all, it's based upon his observation. So it's going to be very limited. And it's also based on his ingenuity, and basically that's the way man studies, that's the way man understands the universe, and that's why man's understanding of the universe is always a weak one, because it's based upon observation. And the way he construes the universe can never be, really, can never be the way it really is. He approaches it, but he can never really understand exactly the way it is. The only one that knows exactly the way it is God, because God understands it, because he knows, because he constructed it, and it has to do with his chachma. And God knows his own chachma. So God knows what we are doing, and what is doing in the universe, not because he observes the distant nebulae, not because he observes what's going on in the cosmos, you see. It's simply because he knows himself. That's what the Rambam says. He knows himself, and by knowing himself, he knows the universe. So, therefore, the question is, since God's knowledge is such that it's based upon his own chokhmah, then you have a problem. The problem is a problem of causality. Because how do you know that how does the person who made the clock know that the clock is ticking is 3 o'clock at a certain time? Because he knows the cause and effects that are involved in the clock. And he knows how it's going to be working a month from now. Therefore, God knows how the universe works, and he knows exactly at a given time what's going to be taking place. But that's all fine in the area of cause and effect. But when you come to Bechira Chofshes, which means man is free, his will is free, so then he's not constrained. It doesn't work with a system of causality. If that's the case, a man is above causality. Because causality in an animal, you could predict what he's going to do. If you understood all the instincts of the animal, you'd know. But with man, there's a free element. He can rise above his instincts. So the question is, since it's a free element, so how can God possibly know what choice a person is going to make at a certain time, you see.
Isn't God aware exactly of each part of the individual?
The question, I know, but then you're going to have to, the question is very simple. The question is that once you say free will, that means to say you're denying a causal chain. Because if you posit a causal chain, then you're going to have to say that from the day the world was created, this person would have to kill this other person. Because there's a chain of causality there. But the moment you tell me that it's not so, that this causal chain does not exist, and man does not have to, this person did not have to kill A, did not have to kill B in 1956, wasn't necessary, so it was up to this individual. So then you have to say that it's, there is no causal chain. There is no causal chain, and the question is, how could God possibly have knowledge of this? That's the basic problem. It's a tremendous, tremendous problem.
It's Minei
Bay. It's Minei Bay. There's no simple solution to this problem. Ram says, Ram mentions in the Yad HaZaka, he says it's a problem that is Gedola, the answer to which is Gedola Midei Eretz Mida, Rachova Menayom. It's one of the biggest problems in philosophy. And the only basic idea, that basic notion that the Rambam gives us is that it's an epistemological notion. The idea is that God's knowledge is not simply cause and effect the way we understand it. Cause and effect is a part of the system of knowledge. But there's a different kind of knowledge. It's God's knowledge. It's beyond cause and effect. Cause and effect is just something that we have. It's cause and effect is an observational type of tool. It's a tool that is used by the observer to uncover. But the whole knowledge, the whole system of the universe does not simply work in cause and effect. There's a different category of knowledge. And if you had that category of knowledge, then you'd be able to know even beyond the causal. And that's God's knowledge. Ram just outlines for us that idea, that the concept that there's that cause and effect sort of is something which fits in, so to speak, subsumed under. It's not a false thing, cause and effect. If it was false, it would be fooled. But it's only a part of the picture. It's not really the ultimate tool of knowledge. Just something. It's a tool of an observer that we're endowed with, and with that we're capable of arriving at certain constructions and understanding certain things. But there's a system of knowledge beyond cause and effect. Yes. See, once you say the man is programmed, that's the Rambam's problem. Once you say the man is programmed, then it would come. Then the result would be that there's no purpose in him. Actually, there's no purpose in man living his life, because if in reality he is programmed, so then he's just acting out a predetermined course.
Every particular that went into it.
The question. The important. What Rambam is saying is as follows. Rambam is saying is that there is no way that any person, no matter how much knowledge of psychology he has, can predict what another human being is going to do. It is impossible, because there is an unpredictable element, and that is the part that has free choice. So no matter how much knowledge of psychology, in other words, all our predictions, our psychological predictions, are based upon one thing. They're based upon the fact that you're working within the instinctual nature of the person. There you can be very predictive. If, for instance, you know, I mean, most people work on an instinctive level. You have to realize that free choice, the more knowledge a person has, the more free he is, because then he's making his decisions based upon his mind. But insofar as he's an emotional individual, he's making his decisions based upon his emotions, he's not really free. That's why a good psychologist can predict the behavior of others, because he's predicting behavior of the others in the realm of the emotional, because these people are on a lower level, they're working on the instinctual, so he can predict if he's good. Even there, they really, I don't think any psychologist maintains he's capable of predicting even there. But am I right? The prediction, they don't. But the fact is, but they will say, yeah, not specific. They will say, because they'll say it's too sophisticated, too complicated to make the prediction. But what Yadis maintains is that there is an area of man which is unpredictable, and you can never predict. In other words, that's really one of the chiyuvim of the Torah, is they have to bring the ideas of the Torah to a person. Let's say you say, look, as far as I know, this individual is not going to do it. You can't do that. You can't make any prediction, because the person has bechira. There is bechira means that there's a part of him that's unconstrained, and that he and that is free to follow a certain pattern. And you can never say that he has powerful emotions and therefore he's not going to be able to do it. Or you can't say it the other way either, that he's a very intellectual person and therefore he's definitely going to make the right choice, because maybe his emotions will overpower him. You see, he is the sole determinant. Now, once you say that, then the problem is, how does God know? Because God doesn't know through observation. Besides, how can the future? You can't observe the future until it happens, until it occurs. And that is the problem. It is a powerful question. As a matter of fact, the Ravid criticized the Rambam for even raising the question, because he says that a lot of people would not have realized the problem had the Rambam not made it so clear. And why did he have to cause so much trouble, especially in view of the fact that he never answers it? You see? But the but the Rambam maintained that it is not a good philosophy to sweep things under the carpet. That it's better that people should know the question, and they should have there's a concept of amunas chachamim, that a person should realize that just because he doesn't understand something doesn't mean another chacham can't understand it. I mean, it can't be that audacious to think that his mind is the end of knowledge, especially if he sees people have more knowledge and more intelligence than him. He should realize that there is a solution, and that the chachamim know the solution, but it's not for his level. That's what the Rambam is. That's the Rambam's approach. Yes. It doesn't contradict the mind in the sense that it tells us that a category of thought that we have is false. What it tells us is a category of thought that we have is not the ultimate category of knowledge. You see? Cause and effect is not the ultimate. It is something. It's a tool. All our ideas, basically. As a matter of fact, with the advance of modern physics, it becomes even more supported that all the things that we have, even mathematics, mathematics is not, if you really think that mathematics is an inherent reality, you're going to get caught up with Zeno's paradox. You can't get out of Zeno's paradox. You're going to get a total contradiction, because you could break up matter infinitely, so how could you cross the room? But when you realize that even the mathematical is only a tool that God gave us for applying and penetrating reality, but it's not the ultimate reality. Not the ultimate reality. So man is endowed by God with certain intellectual abilities which permit him to penetrate the reality, penetrate the physical world. But he doesn't have the ultimate tools. The ultimate tools only God has. We have various tools, but the ultimate tool only God has. And that knowledge, it's hard for us to imagine because we keep on thinking of our knowledge. And we keep on thinking that our knowledge is the ultimate. And therefore, how can anyone else? There's no causality, it's impossible to know. Yeah, it's impossible for us to know because that's all we have. But it doesn't mean that there are no other categories of knowledge which are beyond causality. In a word, what the Rambam answers is that God's knowledge is totally different than man's, and the tools that we use for knowledge are only tools that are given to us to be able to perceive reality to a certain depth. But we can never perceive the universe can never be understood by man. Impossible. He could make structures and constructions, and he could have what they call now. You see, even science today, they get away from the term theory and they use model. So they use the term model. Why do they use the term model? No, there is a good reason. Because model means that they don't really give it such credence as they used to. They used to think, this is the theory and this is it. A model means it's a model, it's a way to envision it. But to say that this is really what's going on is audacious for us. We don't know what's really going on, but we know one thing, that with more advanced models, we are approaching reality with a greater degree. You see, we're capable of doing so many more things than we were able to do before. So obviously we are gaining, we are making progress. But we don't really know ultimately what the realities are, what the ultimate realities are in terms of, we don't know what this table is made out of. Men can never know it. Impossible. See? Atoms, we don't know what an atom is. I have no idea. You have Niels Bohr gave an idea, if he tried to say it's like the planets. It's similar to the planets, and he had his whole structure, but that structure fell apart. I mean, and there's been many structures since then, and none of them really hold up. Because all you could do is to try to envision with our own minds, with our limited minds, the type of structure that will answer this. Like a person sees the clock and he'll think of what type of mechanism is behind the clock. He never saw a man make a clock before. So he'll try to envision in his mind some type of structure that will be responsible for the clock ticking this way. But it's nice, but his chances of really knowing what's the of imagining something that's exactly the way it is are very, very slim. You see. And in this situation, it's not only slim, it's impossible, because the tools that we use, that's the idea of the Pasuk later on, that God's knowledge is totally different than the meager tools that we have. We have very meager tools. Nevertheless, it's incumbent upon us to pursue our knowledge, because God wants us to pursue our knowledge, because the more knowledge we gain, the closer we get. And the closer we get, the greater, the more increase there is in our relationship between God and us. So God wants us to gain knowledge, but nevertheless, our nature doesn't permit the ultimate knowledge. And that's basically the Rambam's answer. It's a tough answer to take, But the Rambam felt that we'd be able to take the blow. Yeah, be able to handle it. The Rambam felt we wouldn't be able to handle such a thing. So the Rambam said he shouldn't have said it. Okay. Yeah. Mishnah is safui, because safui means like an observer. It's like a human term. That's why the Mishnah uses that term. So that's the problem, is because we construe God's knowledge in human terms, and that's why you have this contradiction, this problem. Okay? But it's important to realize that this is just an abstract philosophical question. It's not a practical question. As a matter of fact, the Rishonim never really discuss the idea of whether man is ultimately free or not. You see, the Rishonim only say one thing, and that's why I told you our description. What's our description of free will? Our description of free will is that man has the ability, through knowledge, to understand his instincts, and once he understands them, they lose their hold on him. Because if he understands what emotion is getting him and how it's getting him, he's able to manipulate and able to maneuver. If he doesn't have any understanding, then he can't. He's stuck. So all the Torah says is that a person should take upon himself to study Torah, to gain the true philosophy of life, gain knowledge, and to gain an understanding of himself, so that he knows how to live properly. So unless a person will advise you and will tell you not to go for help, you see, you can't. The whole question is an academic one, whether he has free will or not. Oh, that's why the Rishonim don't even discuss it, because it's an academic question. What are you going to do? He'll tell me, yeah, but when he went for help and when he went for psychotherapy, that was also predicted, and therefore his very going was predicted. And everything was predicted. Fine. But would you advise him to go or not? Or you don't? They certainly advise the man to go. Unless you can tell me, you're not going to advise him to do anything, which itself is absurd. Right? So therefore, in terms of Torah, you have to advise a person to go and to partake of Torah to the greatest degree to improve his life. I mean, it's only a theoretical question. Practically, it has no value whatsoever. You see? Because even if you're going to tell me that there is no free will ultimately, but what are you going to do therefore? You're going to sit back and do nothing? I mean, it's nonsense. Excuse me? Unless you're going to tell me there's no such thing as an improved life, but that's an absurd person. According to Rashi, however, we have to understand Rashi. That's why I told you, people say that the Rambam threw this shot into the Mishnah because he wanted to find. Choice. But the point is, there is no connection between the two statements unless you understand this. Moreover, since you're going to hit this problem, because when you say suffering, as I said before, you can't say God is an observer. That's a very childish idea, that God's an observer. God's knowledge is based upon knowledge of himself, like the Rambam says. And the moment you say that, you see the contradiction immediately. But Rashi didn't go that far. Rashi just said plain shock. Rashi was a Pashtunid. He said, a cult suffering means simply God sees everything that's happening, and a Rishus Nesuna means that you're making a choice. So I'm not saying that Rashi denies what the Rambam says, but apparently Rashi, by not saying it, has to have a different understanding of the relationship between a cult suffering and between a Rishus Nesuna. Now, what is the relationship according to Rashi? We should try to understand what it is. I think Rashi's understanding is a little bit different, and Rashi's understanding is actually removes another problem. According to Rashi, removes the problem of what is it doing in Pirkei Avos? Okay. But how does Rashi understand it? See, I called Sofi Rosh Hashanah. Rashi says God sees everything, and man still man is capable of makes his own choice. What does it mean, basically? What does it mean? So I think it means like this. I think what it means is that there are that what it means is as follows: that the Rishus Nesuna and the Akolt Sofri are two different levels of human cognition. See? Or Rishus Nesuna means that a person can do whatever he wants. It means a person can do whatever he wants. Now, when a person feels that, you see, actually in the problem, you see, the point is as follows. You take a look at the next Mishnah. Take a look at the next Mishnah is really, according to Rashi, is an expansion on this statement. You see? It says, who are you Omer? Now, Hachonus Psucho, Vachenveni Makif, Vapinkis Pasuach, Vayad Koseves, Vachola wrote to the Lavos Yova Vyilva, Vagaboyim Marzirum Tadir Bachol Yom, and Ephraim and Adam Idaito Shlomi Idaito. It's a mushroom. Let's take a look at this mushroom. You see? Now, he says like this. The Rabbeinu Yonah is a nice mashal. It says like this. He says in the next Mishnah, "Who am I? Kol nasin ba'eravon." He says, "Kol mashia ha'odam lokeach min olam azeh, ala kol hu oreg." Whatever a person takes from this world, he's responsible for everything that he takes. Ubonav ha'raven, and his children are responsible. A person shouldn't think that who inherits his father and his mother, that this money is mine, I'll do with it whatever I wish, because he really doesn't have anything of it. It all belongs to God. Whatever he took, with a guarantee, he takes it. And he's going to make him pay for it. What does it mean? It's like this. Moshe la'odam shenichnas l'medina. The moshe, a person that went into a certain country, v'lo matzah shem adam, he didn't find anybody there, nobody was there, empty. Nichnas l'bayas achas, he went into one house, u'matzah shem shulchan aruch, and he found the table was set, v'olav mikol mine machal o'mashke. And on it was all different types of foods and drinks. Vaya ochel v'shosa, the man was eating and drinking. Va'omer, and he says, "Halo b'chol zeh ani zelcha. I have really come to own and to control and to own all of this. V'shaliyako, everything's mine. Nobody's here. Esem menachol ritzoni. I'll do whatever I want with this." He says, and he didn't see that the owner was observing him from the distance. He says, and eventually he's going to have to pay for everything he's eating. And let's say this man is in a situation where he can't escape. There's too many people around there, so he can't escape, he's going to have to pay for it. You see, what does it mean? What does it mean to say? What is the marshal? What is the mushroom? The mushroom's like this, really.
No free lunch.
Yeah. The mushroom is like this. The mushroom is that there are really two frameworks of reality that we live in. You see, in one framework of reality, we imagine ourselves all powerful. When a person makes a choice that Olam Hazeh really is free. I mean, basically that's what they're saying, that the Olam Hazeh is free, because people can do whatever they want here. They're free. I mean, within the limits of the law, of course, because even you see today, I mean, the limits of the law don't really matter too much. I mean, in today's world, but the you see, outside of certain limitations, you're basically free. You're a free individual, whatever you want. God does not constrain you in any way whatsoever. You can do whatever. You have a right to do anything in this world that's in your power. You have total control. You could rob, you could steal, you can kill, you can do anything. You just have to worry about getting away with it in terms of government control. But basically, insofar as that being pushed aside, or ways to get around things like that, you're a free person to do whatever you want, totally free. You see. That's our Rishus Nesuna. But occult suffering means, what does occult suffering mean? Occult suffering means that God is watching everything that is occurring. What does it mean to say that God is watching everything that's occurring? What does it mean? It means to say that there's another framework. There's another framework of reality. But this person that comes into this house and he sees this big suit and he goes and he grabs everything and he feels he's in total control, he's in one framework of reality. It's a denial of the other framework. He's in that framework, he doesn't see the balabais that's standing behind the door, this powerful balabais, and all the people that he has under his control to make sure that this person is not going to leave that Medina without paying what he took. Without paying for what he took, you see. So in terms of his framework, it means the man is seeing reality and is convinced that it's reality, but it's based on a limited framework. He doesn't see the whole system. See, that's the person that enters the house. That's the person that enters the house. But the Hakol Tzofui represents the other side of the picture. Hakol Tzofui means that in actuality, when a person feels that way, it's just his emotions overpower him and convince him that this is the total picture. That this is the total picture. The total picture is that everything's under my control. I have absolute control. Or Rishus Nesuna. Rishus Nesuna means without any repercussions. I can do whatever I want. The sense of Bechira, the sense of free will itself, the sense of free will itself is actually a contradiction to the state of occult suffering. To the state of occult suffering. Because Rishus Nesuna means I can do anything I want. I'm a free individual. That's the emotional force which convinces him, just like that person when he sees that table. Why? Because he has such a desire to have control of whatever is in front of his eyes that he denies that the balabais is standing and observing him from the other room. See, he doesn't want to be in such a framework. There's a denial of the other framework. What Rashi is saying is, in Akol Tzofin or Rishus Nesuna, is that there are two psychological states that man works under. In one state, really, it's zelu mazet. It's like a contradistinction. The reality is Akol Tzofin. That's the reality. Akol Tzofin. Meaning to say that there's nothing that he could do actually in this world that he's not accountable for. Why? Because the world works according to the laws of God, and every move he makes, in everything he does, there is a result. There is a result. Now, there's nothing that's free, you see. Every move he makes, he's either in line with the principle that God has created or he's violating the principle. And every move that he makes and every action that he does is an accountable one. It's a kol tzofui. Even the slightest move. But a Rishus Nesuna is the sense that man has when he operates under a certain psychological framework where he senses that he's simply free to do whatever he wishes to do. And it's true, he is free because there's no constraint. But he's not free in the sense that he imagines that that there is no accountability for what he is doing. He's free to make the choice. That's a Rishus Nesuna, you see. But the Hakol Tzofui means that it's true that the Rishus is Nesuna and he's free to make the choice, but simultaneously he's not free to make the choice as a person who has control over the situation and simply can is just let loose on a situation, he can just do whatever he wants. See, that doesn't exist. Why doesn't that exist? Because Akol Tzofui. That's the Akol Tzofui. According to Rashi, the Akol Tzofui and the Rishus Nesuna are two different psychological planes that a person acts under. And a person in his lifetime acts under both of them. Of course, the purpose in life is to be in line with the framework of Akol Tzofui. But the framework of a Rishus Nesuna is the framework in which people find themselves too often. They're operating under the concept of a Rishus Nesuna. That's when Obolsky made his moves, which is illegal moves, or any person for that matter who at that moment he's under the psychology of a Rishus Nesuna. A Rishus Nesuna. It's a certain force in man that overpowers the person at the moment, and it's a psychological phenomenon. And to him at that time, it's Rishus Nesuna. What he forgets is that there's another reality. His soul is not in the state of Dakol Tzachli. Not in the state of Dakol Tzachli. The one who describes it best, is Shlomo Melech. Shlomo Melech describes it best in Mishle, in Perek Zion, where he mentions the Isha Zora. The Isha Zora is a mushal, the Isha Zora. Kerisha means a zona, means a prostitute. But it's a mushal. The prostitute represents the emotional part of man that draws him and convinces him. You see? And that's why he says, in the beginning of Mishle Yizayin, he says, B'ni shmor amorai u'mitzvosai titzponitach. Shmor mitzvosai v'chiyei. It's an interesting thing. You see, in Yadis you have an interesting phenomenon. You have not only do you have the chachma, but also you have the experiential. A lot of the experiential in Yadis. In other words, it's not just a system of logics where you just state philosophical principles. If that was the case, the Torah wouldn't be written the way it was. It would just be a system of principles, you know, one after another. All principles of human psychology and philosophy, and that's it. But you see, but the Torah is written in a different form. Why? The Torah is written in a story form. Why? Because the Torah is interested in bringing the experiential also. Experiential is very important. That's why in Mishle Perek Zayin is a nice example, where he says, Koshrei malatz b'isecha, koshrei maloch lebecha, emala chachma chosiyach. Say to chachma that you are my sister. What does it mean to say to chachma you are my sister? It means to say that he recognizes that chachma is really the underlying reality. You see? Just like a person has feelings towards his family which are very strong, and to him it's the underlying reality of his actions, the way he does things. You see? Over here, chachma really should be, you have to make a trade. You have to trade those emotional feelings of reality for chachma, and realize that chachma is everything. The world is guided by chachma. And once you recognize the world is guided by chachmas Hashem, you recognize you have to leave all those things which fool you into thinking that you're in line with reality based upon your emotions. But you have to realize only one thing to be in line with reality with, and that's what chachma. That's emol chachma chosiyat. And what does he say in the next pasuk? L'shmorcha me'isha zorah. To save you from the strange woman. That means the prostitute. Minochria amoreha achlika. Who has very... Achlika, amoreha achlika means that her tongue is very skillful. And you're skillful in seducing a person, you see? He says, Kibachalon Basi, because out of the window of my house, Ba'adesh Nabi Neshkafti, I looked out of the window of my house, Va'era Bapsoim, and I saw among the fools, Avina Babanim, I understood among the young sons, Nar, a young lad, Chasar Lev, who was devoid of heart, means to say that he didn't have the part of him that is chachma. And then he gives a whole description. Over Bashuk Eitzelpino, he walks in the marketplace next to her corner, which means to say, what is the mashal? The mashal is that he's first the person haphazardly is walking by the Isha Zara. It's as if he doesn't even know why he's there, actually. He doesn't even understand why he's there. But there's some unconscious force that causes him to walk by the corner of the Isha Zara. He happens to be there. He thinks that it's just an accident. But it's not. There's some subtle force that's driving him there. The derech beisa yitzav. He actually steps around the way of our house. And he says b'neshef be'erev yom be'ishon laila v'achela in the evening in the dusk in the darkness of night. What are all these terms? All these terms are basically to demonstrate that the person is completely blocked out the other reality. Vine Isha Lakrosa, and he goes through a whole description, Omiya Visasaras, all the description, it's a beautiful description, it's experiential. I mean, he shows exactly, step by step, how the person falls. Whole description. But basically, what is it? What is he saying? But he was looking, why does he have himself in that scene looking through the window? Why does he have himself in that scene? Shlomo puts himself in the scene, like a painter that paints himself into the corner of the picture. Why did he paint himself in there? Why did he put himself in there? What does he represent, really? He represents the force of reality. You see, he's looking. He's the cold observer, the one that's aligned with Chachma. That's the same mushal, very much the same as the mushal as the Rabbeinu Yonah gives, where the person comes in, he thinks he's free, he found the whole table full of full of goods, things that he wants, but he doesn't recognize in the corner the balabayas is observing. That's the reality of our cold suffering. He simply pushes away the reality of our cold suffering. So the reason why the Mishnah places them in juxtaposition, a cold suffering or a shust and sunnah, is because it's a psychological reality. When a person is a chote, when a person does a sin, he's not in the world of a cold suffering anymore. Then he's in the world of a shust and sunnah. But not the true, not just the recognition. It's more than just he's able to do it, but he feels he has total power over the situation. And he denies the occult suffering. That's why the Mishnah puts those two together, according to Rashi. According to the Rambam, it represents a philosophical problem. That's the purpose of the Mishnah. Rashi doesn't disagree with the Rambam. But the Rambam considers the Mishnah to be referring to a very deep philosophical problem. Whereas Rashi learns the Mishnah to be actually referring to a psychological phenomenon in man. Psychological phenomenon. I wouldn't like to miss any of the points over here because I think they're important. Important points. The question is the order of which in which we take them, but the order isn't really that important. The main thing is that we cover all the points here. Now let's take a look at the Tes Zayin. Tes Zayin. Who are your Omer? Okay. Shlishi. Hakol Nasan Bei Rahon. What does it mean, Akol Nasan by Ravon? Akol Nasan by Ravon? So, Akol Nasan, take Rabbeinu Yonah. Akol Nasan by Ravon. There's not too much, you know, it's all a muscle over here that the Mishnah. I'm going to go back to Betuvah and Nadan. Actually, Betuvah and Nadan is more of a philosophical point, and the other is more of a psychological point. Okay. Yeah. Of course, the area. I mean, as I mentioned many times, I spoke last week about the fact that the experiential that Yadis differs from the other philosophers, in that it expresses things in experiential terms, and rather than just give a whole philosophical system, a list of principles like Aristotle does, but the Torah doesn't seem to do it that way. Like Mishlei and Kehelas and Tehillim and Avos, I mean, it's all a different approach. The reason why it's a different approach is because the purpose of Yadis is to teach man the perfection of the soul. And therefore, Yadis really invented a psychological philosophy. Because in order for the soul to be perfected, it requires both. It requires the proper psychology, but psychology alone is nothing. Because psychology only deals with the person psychologically healthy, it means that he has avoided the problems of neuroses and psychoses. What psychologists today call neuroses and psychoses. But then there is that means in terms of the species he's healthy, but the species itself is inherently ill. There's an inherent illness in man, and for that it's necessary for perfection for a person to know philosophy and to remove himself from the repressions of the species itself. Repression of the species itself. It could be healthy. Healthy means normal, but normal is not really perfection. Normal means that his psyche is geared towards geared properly, but the normal itself is ill because man is inherently a sick being, and without Torah, without knowledge, he cannot rise above the normal. And to remain in the state of the normal is not the perfection for Yadis. That's why in Yadis you have a science of psychological philosophy. It's a combination of both. And in order for a person to instruct another person in that area, it's necessary to identify the specific states that the human mind lives by. are certain psychological states that have to be identified. And without identifying those states, you really can't perceive what perfection is. You can't describe what it is. So a person can have all the principles, and that was really the mistake of the ancient philosophers, because the ancient philosophers had many points, as the Rambam says, many points that the Torah agrees on. But the only thing is, they didn't have a system of pointing out to people the various, they were weak in the psychological area. They weren't able to point out to people the various, identify the various psychological states, and to recognize them, because through recognition, then we could understand those states, and we could strive to rise above them. But you have to have a recognition of those states. That's why in Yadus you have a science of psychological philosophy, which goes through Tehillim and Mishle and Kehelis and Nevi'im and the Torah itself in many cases. And of course, Avos is an expansion on this whole system. So you'll notice that the Mefarshim and the Rabbeinu Yonah especially always quote Psukim. Rashi quotes Psukim from Eiv, from the various sources in Nevi'im. Yeah. Okay. Now, the various sources in the Vina, mainly really Ksuvim, really, more than the Vina, Ksuvim mainly. Okay. So let's just continue. Just a side point, but I think it's one that we should know, is the difference between the Vina and Ksuvim. Gemara Megillah Gimel Amud Aleph, the Gemara says, that by Daniel. Daniel, of course, is the Ksuvim. So it says, "V'ra'isi ani Daniel levadi et Hamara, v'anashim asher hoyu imi lo ro'u et Hamara, avol charada gedola nafla aleihem, v'yivrechu be'echoveh." Daniel says, "I alone saw the vision, and the people that were with me did not see the vision. But a great fear fell upon them, and they ran away and they hid." So the Gemara says, "Man miyu anashim? Who are these people?" Amar Rabbi Yirmiyahu of the Tamer of Priya Baraba, "Zechagai Zechaya Malachi." These were these three Nevi'im. Chagai Zechariah Malachi, the last of the Nevi'im. The Gemara says, "Inu adifu minei, ve'iyu odif minayo." They were superior to him, and he was superior to them. "Inu adifu minei," they were superior to him, "ve'inu Nevi," because they were Nevi'im. "Ve'iyu lav Navi," but he wasn't a Navi. Okay? Then it says, "Iyu adif minayo," but he was superior to them. Why? "The iyu chaza," because he was able to see the vision. "The inu lo chaza," they weren't able to see it. So what does the Gemara mean? So Rashi explains, "The inu nevi she nisnabu yisro b'shlichusa shel mako." What does it mean? "Nevi" means that they prophesied to the people of Israel. They prophesied to the people of Israel at the behest of God, shlichus, as emissaries of God, shlichus yomachal. V'hu lo nishtalach liYisrael b'shem nevuah, but he was never sent to be nisnabe. Daniel himself was never sent to be nisnabe, to prophesy to the people of Israel. So you see that there's two types of nevuah. One type of nevuah is the nevuah that's Nevi'im. Nevi'im is the nevuah that the certain individuals were chosen to be sent for Klal Yisrael to give them to prophesy for them. That was Chagai Zechariah Malachi was a Nevi'im. And Daniel was not. Daniel was not a Navi. An interesting thing. The Gemara says apparently that there's a certain perfection that's necessary in order to be chosen as one who is sent to prophesy for Klal Yisrael. Certain type of perfection. Because the Gemara says that inu adif minei, that they were superior to him. You see. But then it says, but iu adif minayo, that he was superior to them. Why? Because it says, v'ra'isi ani Daniel levadi etamara, I alone saw the vision. But anashim ashari oyumi lo rasamara, but the people who were with me did not see the vision. Which means to say that he was capable of a certain perception, a certain understanding, a certain knowledge that the other Nevi'im were not capable of. It's an interesting, very interesting remark. I mean, what exactly? It would seem that you could understand on the contrary. It seems one that That's sent b'shlichus shemakom. Okay, fine. Good aura. But he certainly had a great level of nevuah. But it would seem that the one who saw the mara, Daniel, would seem to be superior, because he was able to see the vision that they were incapable of seeing, which means he was able to perceive a deep understanding of God's knowledge than they were. He alone saw the mara, and these Nevi'im couldn't see. But Nevi'im basically, in Ksuvim rather, Ksuvim is Dvarim Stumim. The difference between Nevi'im and Ksuvim is that Nevi'im were the words of the prophet that were sent to Shlichus HaShemakom, and Ksuvim were just ideas, concepts, ideas. Dvarim Stumim, the Gemara says. I mean, not the Gemara, the Pasuk says. Dvarim Stumim, Pasukim in Daniel. That we don't understand many of these Pasukim. They're Stumim, lace cakes. Till the end of time. So the Ksuvim represent certain deep concepts, deep ideas that even the Nevi'im are incapable of perceiving. But they weren't words that were spoken to the people. That's why that the Rabbi Chaim said the difference between Nevi'im and Ksuvim is not like the Rambam says in the Maran Ruchim. He said the difference between Nevi'im and Ksuvim is that Nevi'im became the words of the Nevi'im became Kisvei Kodesh through the fact that they were spoken, but the words of the Ksuvim not. Ksuvim, it's a different type of phenomenon. The words of the Ksuvim not. So the Ksuvim were never spoken. The words of Ksuvim became Kisvei Kodesh not through the fact that they were not through speaking to the people. But it was simply the perception of certain concepts, certain ideas, certain philosophical principles. That's the difference between the Vim and the Ksuvim. You see, the Gemara says, "Inu adif minayo." Apparently, that there's a certain perfection in the Navi that Daniel didn't have, which means in order to be a shliach, to be sent to shlichus hashemakom, requires one type of perfection. And in order to be able to see and perceive certain abstract concepts and ideas, that Dvarim Stumim, that are hidden ideas that people can't perceive, that's a different type of perfection. Two different types of nevuah. And mostly, as I said before, the words of the Mefarshim bring down the words of the Ksuvim. Words of the Ksuvim. Okay. Now,
that's true.
Yeah. Okay. At any rate, let's just take a look at this Mishnah over here. So what does it say? It says, "Hakol nasan b'ayrahim." Hakol nasan b'ayrahim. It's an interesting thing that Nevi'im go on top of Ksuvim. They're not conversing. Nevi'im go on top of Ksuvim. Interesting. No. See, Rambam and Mora says it was written with two different types of Nevuah. That Stumim was Ruach HaKodesh. It wasn't on the same lower level. Something that requires more explanation. I'm just mentioning it, you should have an idea, a basic idea, difference between the two, but we're really not expanding on what the underlying concept is. It's a deep idea, obviously, there. I'm going to leave for another time. At any rate, what does the Mishnah say? It says like this: Hu ayom akol nasan boi ravon. What does it mean, akol nasan boi ravon? So we'll take the Rabbanian. Rabbanian says like this. He says, "Kol ma shadun lakeich min olam hazeh ala kol ha'aretz." Whatever a person takes from this world, he's responsible for everything. Ubonav ha'aretz, and his children are responsible. We mentioned this last week. The person shouldn't say, "Yachshav ha'yorech yisov v'asimo zeh mamon yirushasa." The person shouldn't think he inherits his father and his mother. This mamon is his. Esav meno kol ratzoni. I'll do whatever I want with it. She'ein lo b'shelo klum. He doesn't really have any ownership at all. Kila Hashem akol. Everything belongs to God. Whatever he takes from God, he has to accept the responsibility for. Eventually, he's going to be accounted. He's going to have to account for what he took. And then he gives the mashal of the person that went into the Medina, like we mentioned last week, and he saw all this table which was prepared and everything, and he figured that it's all his, but he didn't notice the balabayas is watching from the corner. Okay, that's Hakol Nasan Beirava. Next he says, Umetsuga Prusal Kalachaya. And the net is spread out upon all the living. What does it mean, the net is spread out? So he says, Zuha Misa. This refers to death. shenigzura. The einod adam yachol lehinatzel mimeno. The person cannot escape from it. Kedogim hanechazim b'mtzuda ra. He quotes Kehelet. Tzuda. It's like fish that are caught in an evil snare. So the yomam of this is an inescapable phenomenon. Yeah. Next it says achonas psucha. Let's go through the whole thing and we'll try to put together what the idea is. Achonas psucha. The store is open. He says shebnei adam nichnasim l'sham. People walk into the store. That's this world. The lokhin kol mashatzrichanato, and they take everything they need now. Zain roenas anola. They don't see what the future holds. What will eventuate from their actions. V'lo choshvin ba'agia zman ha'piron, and they don't consider when the time of payment will arrive. In other words, they don't figure out whether they're going to be able to pay for the food that they're taking. Since they see it's open, then that's it. They can take everything for fisha. Fisha means momentary, at the moment. They can take everything. That's how people are in this world. Then it says, V'achen v'ni makif. The storekeeper writes down everything that they take. Zeh balachanus. Shenosin l'acherim ba'kofi yayin. He gives the wine and goods. He gives it to them, but he puts it on the bill, charges it. And later he charges them. Kach shalit ba'olamo, nosin l'chol boy olam kol cheftam. So the one who rules the world, God, he gives to the people who live in the world whatever they want. He tells them raw. Good or bad, he doesn't care. They can take anything. They're so fully par mayam l'chazman. But eventually he's going to collect. He's going to collect them. Okay. Then it says, v'apinkis pasuach. Pinkis pasuach means, and the book is, the ledger is open, right. Ledger is open. V'shnei yonim nema davar zeh. So the Rebbeinu says that this is said for two reasons. Yeah. One is a mashal. Why can't shichol if nechisei chavodah? There's no such thing as forgetting before God. Because he writes it down and he learns it to many people. Mayhem la lofim urvavos. Mayhem ledina. Imlo mitneis rizuso shapinkis psuchalafonov miyad kasvas ako lefam mohaya shacheach dvarim ktanim negedolim mayhem aval peh. He says, but if it was, why doesn't he tell you that the ledger is open? Because if it was, it's a marshal. I mean, say that a person would walk into a store and you see the owner is not taking any account, so he figures that he's going to forget small items. He may remember big ones, but small ones he's going to forget. But over here, nothing is forgotten. Even the small thing is remembered. You see? Kloma, v'alzenim ha'av pinkas p'sucho v'hayad kaseves. Kloma, b'ina ha'toyim ha'gdolim v'aktanim kulom kilu l'fonim v'stavim v'lo shachach ha'vonis v'shonim. Everything is remembered, and God doesn't forget the first sins, first things that the first transgressions that a person did. Vasheni lo diyono ki ein mamtinin lepsichas apinkas acha sheosa achet. Second idea here is that there is no time lapse between the doing of the chet and between having it written down, which means to say like this: Elo b'gmara maisa kvar. It's telling you that as soon as he does the action, as soon as the person enters the store and takes the object, immediately it's written down. So who cares whether it's immediate or whether it's later? He says no. He says, here Rabbeinu says a very interesting thing. He says, Kidei shelo yavo rega shelo nimna olav ha'ovonaho. It's telling you that a minute doesn't go by that this sin that he performed isn't written down. Shavo pi shavonas nimchom lebala tshuva. Even though a person does tshuva and the sin is forgiven, he says, nimnin osan chila. First, they're written down. Miyad shegomru lasosan. Immediately after he did the avera. Vachrechein im yachso v'tshuva mochmul. And then later, if he does tshuva, so then they'll forgive him. So what's the difference? Who cares? What's the difference if it's written down first? He does tshuva later, it's not written down. Because once he does tshuva, it's gone. The avera is gone. Right? That's what everybody understands it. Rabbeinu Yonah says no. He says like this. He says no. Kedamina b'medrash eino k'misha lo asal. The medrash says it's not as if a person didn't do the avera when he does tshuva. Interesting. Everybody thinks that it's simply removed. Ela asal v'nimcho. But he did the avera and he was forgiven for the avera. Shegodol misha eino asa. Misha osa mochon. Better if a person didn't do an avera than a person that did an avera and had the avera forgiven. Interesting, Rabbeinu Yonah. But there are chazal we know that are against this. And he quotes one of them. Ma shama ain tzaddikin gemurim omdim b'makom shabala tshuva omdim sham. The chazal say that a tzaddikin gemurim, even tzaddikin gemurim, cannot stand in the place where bale tshuva are, which means to say bale tshuva are on a higher level. That's what the implication would be. So he says, Ratzalama. He says, no. Shabale tshuva yesh lehem li parish min amosa ki'inyin shechotabo kimom avral harayas rafilu b'ishto yesh lisnai gima b'midas apishas b'davar shechotabo yifrosh rafilu min amutu yosem yima shatavikin gomor sichon lasas. He says, no, this doesn't mean that. It means on the contrary. It means that the one who does the avera and then repents, then he does tshuva. He says he is not on the same. He's not on the same level as a person who never did the avera. On the contrary, the person who did the avera always has to be aware of the avera, and he has to remove himself even from those things that are permissible. For instance, if he sinned in the area of the sexual laws, ochas harayas. So then he must remove himself from that situation further. He further remove himself, even though something's permissible, he must remove himself from that situation even further because he once fell through with regard to that particular area. That's what Rabbeinu Yonah says. So it comes out that Makom Shebal Shivam and Ansim Gomorrah, it means on the contrary. It means that they're worse off. It means that they're worse off. That the protect themselves more. Interesting Rabbeinu Yonah. Interesting Rabbeinu Yonah. Yes. The Rabbeinu Yonah is different cases. Not Makom Shabbalashiva Balashiva Omdim Ainsat Gemur Yochal Lamad. It means Omdim. He has a different case. It means that they're not on the same platform. That's the way he learns. Interesting Rabbeinu Yonah. It's a very difficult Rabbeinu Yonah. The Rambam in Hilchos Tshuva does not agree with this, because the Rambam says like this. The Rambam says, "Val yidna adam bal tshuva who shul meruchok mimaylas atzadikin." Person of bal tshuva shouldn't imagine that he's far away from the level of the tzadikin because of the sins and the averus that he did. Ain't a davakein. It's not so. Ela all v'nechmod ufnei aborei ki lochatam yolam. Interesting Rambam. Rambam says, but he's beloved by God as if he never sinned ever. His reward is very great. Because he tasted what the avera is like, and nevertheless he controlled himself and he removed himself from it. The other guesses. That they are on a higher level because they have more kriyas hayetzer, more control than the tzaddikim gemurim. So the Rambam seems to disagree. The question I have is a Gemara. It seems to be against the Rabbeinu Yonah. Gemara and Brachas. The Gemara and Brachas is like this. I know we're gonna have a steer my Brachas. I know it's gonna be a problem. There's a Gemara like this. Interesting Gemara. Gemara says in Brachas stuff, Lamed Dalar Amadei? Yeah. Gemara says, Amar B'Yechem. Interesting Gemara. It's all on one pasuk. Kol Nevi'im Kulam Lo Nisnabu Ela Lemesi Bito L'Tamad Chocham Elo Sepam Takim Machil L'Tamad Chocham Ela Mahana Tamad Chocham En Achosav Aval Tamad Chocham Atzmon Ayin L'Rosel Kinzul Asecha Yaseh L'Machak Elo. Alright? He says all the good things that the Nevi'im say will happen. Interesting Gemara. Gemara says, are only referring to a person who marries his daughter to the Talmud Chacham, or who does business for the Talmud Chacham, or who gives the Talmud Chacham to enjoy from his nechassim, from his property. But the Talmud Chacham himself, ayin lo rosa lekim zelo sechel. Talmud Chacham himself, the Navi is not talking about. What does it mean? What does it mean? Nesi bivil Talmud Chacham, osa parkamachil Talmud Chacham, mahana Talmud Chacham and nechassim. What does that represent? Why does Moshe choose that? It's an individual action. It's a lot of mitzvahs. Why does he choose that? What it means to say is like this, that there are two levels of perfection. There's one level of perfection where an individual recognizes what a perfected person is. You see? That's a very interesting chazal. He recognizes what a perfect what a perfected person is. That's a level. I mean, it has to be a level of shleimus adam. It's a level of human perfection. Reminds me of what Will Durant one time said. Will Durant, he wrote the books on the philosophers. He wrote about all the philosophers. So he said that I am a lover of the lovers of wisdom. That I'm a lover of the lovers of wisdom. Okay? It means that he really, that was, his life's work was he appreciated the great minds. But he put it very nicely. He was an appreciate of the great minds. You see? But he wasn't a great mind himself. But that's a level. That's a level. That's what it means. It means that he could appreciate the beauty of a great mind, but he himself was not the great thinker, was not the great mind. That's what the Chazal is, interestingly enough, Chazal is saying. That's what it means. Nesi bitl Talmud Chacham means he wants to associate with the Talmud Chacham. Marries his daughter to Talmud Chacham, he helps him in business. So he appreciates what it is that a person is a Chacham. He has an appreciation of the character of a Talmud Chacham. He recognizes what the perfection is. But he himself is not a Talmud Chacham. He's not on the level where he himself has the vision of that the Talmud Chacham has. The Talmud Chacham has a certain vision, a certain perception, a certain reality. So the Gemara says that this pasuk is saying whatever the Nevi'im or Misnabe, all the good that the Nevi'im said that will befall the people in the future is a reference to those who have that appreciation. That prophecy will come true for those people who have the appreciation of what perfection is. That's a very high level. Very few people in the world are on such a level. But the Gemara says, but those people who are the Talmid, who have the vision themselves, those people, those the Talmid HaChamim who see the Chachma itself, that's a different kind of a level. Ayin la rasa la kin zeh lasech. Only God knows what the good that they will receive is. It's a different kind of a good. But the Nevi'im, it means to say like this, it means to say the Talmud Chacham who has this perception is a person who is in a different world completely, and therefore the good that the Navi is talking about is not appropriate for him, because the good that the Navi is talking about partakes a lot of the physical. And the physical, as long as when the person perceives what Talmud Chacham is, he still has not removed himself totally from the world of the physical. There's a Plato that's very similar. Plato says that a person when he on the road to perfection, first he perceives what it the perfected souls and becomes attached to the perfected souls. That would be to the Talmud Chacham. But then later, when he himself becomes a great Chacham, all he has in front of him is reality. Different kind of vision, different kind of perception. You see, that's ayin la rasa la kin zeh lasech. That good that they will receive, the only one that knows what it is God. The Navi never even described it. That's the far above. It's a different type. It's a different quality. That's what it means. Different kind of quality. But those who perceive the perfection of who recognize what Talmid HaChamim are, they will receive the Nevuah that the Navi speaks about. But that's a very high level. I mean, that's what I'm saying. I mean, he's not putting down the level of of those individuals. I mean, you have people that don't even understand what a Talmud Chacham is. It's a high level to be able to understand what it is. But the Talmud Chacham himself is on a different plane altogether. That's the Gemara. Now the Gemara says like this. Gemara goes on. Vomar al-Khir bar-alam yechon and kol-anzim kum l'nisnabu al-yimosa Mashiach. These Nevuahs are only speaking about the time when the Mashiach comes. Aval olam haba, but what olam haba is, ayin lo ros ala kim zolosach. Means to say that there's the emosim Mashiach and after that olam haba. So the Gemara says that the emosim Mashiach will be a great time. And the Navi prophesies what that great time, what constitutes that great time.